This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
Richard Allen's entire case starts with a piece of paper, a probable cause affidavit signed by Detective Tony Liggett on October 27th of 2022. That convinced a judge to let police search Allen's home, and that search gave them a gun. That gun gave them an arrest, and that arrest put Allen in solitary confinement, where 5 months later he started confessing while eating his own feces and drinking toilet water. But here's the problem. The appeal lays out in devastating detail. According to defense attorneys, that affidavit just was incomplete. It wasn't just incomplete. It was manipulated, allegedly. Witnesses' descriptions were changed. Key details were omitted. And the judge saw bore little resemblance to what investigators actually knew. If Liggett lied or recklessly misled that judge, every single piece of evidence that followed, the gun, the bullet match, the confessions, could be fruit of a poisoned tree. So let's talk about what was actually in that affidavit and what wasn't, and whether Richard Allen's conviction was built on a foundation of deception, because it sure feels like it is. Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, is with us to help us break all of this down. I know you guys have been going through it over on your channel this week. I was watching some of that. You guys were going page by page, weren't mm-hmm. you? And like really doing this thing. Let's just kind of start here with some of the specific claims that Detective Liggett told the judge, describing the man she saw wearing a blue jacket and was muddy and bloody. But the actual claim from Sarah Carbar was just muddy, and it was a tan jacket, actually.
Yeah.
Neither of which made it to what Judge Gull saw, because she saw this other alternate version of reality that Mr. Liggett seemed to want to convey to the judge for some reason. Let's start there.
Yeah, it's and good morning, Tony and Tracy. How are you guys? So we've been eagerly anticipating this thing dropping, and you know, you kind of have no idea what they're going to identify as issues for the appeal, right? And I don't know if people have like a very like firm understanding of how appeals work, but when you're talking about a direct appeal, and I know this isn't going directly to your question, but I'll get to it. But I just want people to understand kind of at the forefront that when you're talking about a direct appeal, that you are limited to the record. Mm-hmm. Okay. But the record is starting from arrest, going through the entire pretrial process, and then ending through trial. Okay,
so you can't put anything in that you've just discovered.
Correct. So if you've got newly discovered evidence, that is post-conviction petition stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're not going to find those things in a direct appeal. So that's what the appellate lawyers are dealing with. They're looking at everything. And as you can see here, Tony, they're starting with the very first thing that happened, which was the search warrant of Richard and Kathy's house.
Yeah.
So that's what they're going back to. So when you're talking about this type of a situation wherein the defense is looking at it and they're saying, okay, here's what happened, is that the cops went in and they either out and out lied, or they misstated the facts, or they omitted important facts that mm-hmm. would have been important for the judge to know. Now, so what happened here and what you just highlighted are clearly situations where Liggett went in and changed what were the actual statements from the witnesses.
Yeah.
In order to suit his needs, which yeah. was to get a search warrant for Richard Allen's house. So when you were kind of going through your introduction to this particular section we're talking about, you were talking about the concept of the fruit of the poisonous tree. So this is argued pretty heavily, and the appellate attorneys for Richard Allen have taken the position that, like, look, okay, this is a situation wherein we feel that this is clear cut in terms of the fact that he has violated the law and therefore has violated Richard Allen's rights, and that this warrant was invalid based on the fact that he came in and lied about the things that you just spoke of and the things that we're going to talk about here in the next few minutes.
Yeah.
And that as a result of that, everything that happened subsequent has become fruit of the poisonous tree. And the easiest way to kind of describe that is just think of an actual tree, mm-hmm. a fruit tree that has roots that are under mm-hmm. the water. And say that you went out and poured a bunch of bleach or arsenic or whatever is going to kill that fruit that mm-hmm. that tree is going to bear at some point. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about fruit of the poisonous tree. So you've got the underlying malfeasance by law enforcement or violation of a constitutional right that happens at the root of the tree. So everything else that comes from that particular malfeasance then mm-hmm. is poisoned. So yeah. they're making the argument that, yeah. all right, so they lied to get the search warrant. From the search warrant, they were able to get the clothing that they claim is bridge guys. They're able to get the weapon that they claim the unspent round matches and all the devices that they grab. And then from that, they go and arrest Richard Allen. So they're saying, okay, the arrest is invalid. That's fruit of the mm-hmm. poisonous tree. But for Liggett going in front of that judge and lying about those things that we just talked about, they don't get an arrest warrant.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're saying the confessions, fruit of the poisonous tree. But for the illegal warrant, but for him getting arrested from that illegal warrant, he's not being held in solitary, driven to madness, and making those confessions. Fruit of the poisonous tree.
Yep.
So essentially, they're saying that everything that happens post-arrest that was born out of that warrant is done. It should be yep. done. That they shouldn't be able to use it.
And what I find interesting about this case is, you know, the fruit of the poisonous tree, we've seen in other cases where, okay, then you sometimes have the argument, well, you know, the methods justify the means or the means justify the method because what they find later is so damning. They don't find anything damning. Like, right. that's the thing. Like, okay, so they're picking the fruit off the poisonous tree, and it's like, well, this isn't even fruit. This is a hoagie. Why the fuck is there a hoagie growing on this tree? I mean, it's just like, it doesn't even make sense. Like, so there's nothing on his, there's no digital evidence. There's nothing that they find. They find the type of gun, and then obviously even that's a big fuck up too, where they compare the bullets to a spent round to an unspent round and say, see, same thing, because their first round produces jack shit. It's just, I mean, it's one thing after another. So it's not like later on they're like, yeah, but we found all this stuff. This really is, it is our guide without a doubt. So, you know, that's just going to be what it's going to be, which we see very often. But in this case, still, there was nothing good that comes about it. I want to talk about another element of this. Betsy Blair, she's central to this warrant. So we just talked about the tan coat being a blue coat and blood and mud and all that. How about this? The descriptions that were also used to get the warrant. She's describing Bridge Guy as a white male in his 20s with brown curly poofy hair, and she rated the sketch artist 10 out of 10. You did an amazing job. This is great. I'd recognize him in a lineup. Richard Allen was 44 short and had closely cropped hair.
How does that even work?
So obviously bit of a discrepancy. And then you have the other person who gives their description, again not the same at all, but somehow what does the judge end up hearing? What was the word that he used? It was like it was very similar. He was basically describing to the judge, they're very similar to what we're looking for. Basically, yeah. It's like, no, not at all what was said.
Yeah, no. And look, the first thing that I want to say though about appeals is that people need to understand that it is incredibly, incredibly difficult to win on direct appeal.
Yeah,
it just is. So like, I want people, because Tony, I know where you're at on this case, and it's at the same place that I'm at on it. And like, I'm reticent to be critical of the brief itself because I don't want, you know, for whatever reason, they watch our content because we have an awful lot of Delphi content. Yeah. I don't want to give the state any ideas in terms of how to challenge. And that's to say, we're not dealing with Nick McClellan writing this response brief. We're dealing with the attorney general. So, and theoretically, we're dealing with some smarter attorneys.
Yeah.
So it's not to say that they're not going to be, you know, so like I've been like there's parts of it that I'm like, man, I really wish that they would have stuck this in there. Like really, really wish they would have stuck this in there. But in terms of Betsy Blair, and when you're talking about all these eyewitnesses and it's that thing where I was talking about where the judge is not only hearing just misstatements of what the witnesses said and but he's omitting things on top of it. So it's lies by omission. And it's flat out lies of what were said. And a judge sitting on the bench has no idea what's true and what's not true.
No, she's relying on these people to do their jobs. And exactly. I mean, she can't go out there and be the investigator as well.
Yeah. Well, this is Diener at that point. Like, yeah. This is pre-Gull.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing what was put together here. And the analogy I made the other day, remember back like in the 80s and like 60s, 70s movies and stuff where, oh, here's the threat letter or the ransom letter. And it would be like newspaper clipping words and magazine words all pasted together. Mm-hmm. And oh, here's the letter. Like, and it's all it's done like that to hide who the identity
this is. Typical serial killer letter. Yeah,
that's what this feels like. Yeah. It feels like the arrest warrant to get signed was like, literally, we're going to take a couple words from here and a couple words from this and a couple that, and see, when you put it all together, it makes a sentence. Like, yeah, but that's not at all what the original sentence is where you took those words from. But see, it is. That's like, that's what this damn thing feels like.
You're 100% right. That's exactly what it feels like because that's what it was. You know what I mean? Like there is at this point in time, if you're looking at it, forget about innocence or guilt at this juncture.
Yeah.
Just look at it with intellectual honesty and ask yourself the question, is this the kind of police work that we're going to allow to happen in this country in terms of trying to secure convictions in cases? Is it okay for them to make shit up to suit their needs in order to get an arrest on a case? Are we going to give them a pass? Is that the country that we want to live in?
Well, and that's here's my question. I'm trying to think of how to phrase this. If this can happen to Richard Allen, it can happen to anybody who's watching this podcast right now.
Yeah.
And what I want to know what the F their purpose is in doing this. Was it because of pressure in the community to get whoever this was off the streets? I mean, we need somebody right now. This guy came forward and pretty much self-confessed that he was in the area. Take him down. I mean, do you think that's what's going on here? Or are these people just evil somehow?
I don't necessarily think, if you're asking me on the front end, if I think that they're evil in terms of intent, I don't think so. Okay. If you're asking me if they're evil once they realize that what they were doing was a big, giant, steaming pile of shit and that they were railroading an innocent man, it's a different answer.
Yeah, I get you.
So like when I like, because I think Richard Allen nailed it in his first interrogation/interview with Mullins and Liggett, where he's sitting there and you know, like, he's like, I'm getting the sense that you're making me a patsy here.
Yeah. He nailed it right away.
And the most telling audio that the jury didn't hear in terms of his jailhouse confessions is the audio that precedes his first "I did it" confession to Kathy, where he calls his stepfather at his, you know, his mom's house, and Ken's on the phone with them, and he says that shit where he's like, I can feel it. I'm starting to lose my mind. He's like, I don't know if you're going to be able to trust anything that I say. It like, moving forward, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, and this is where he's like, I know that you guys know that there's no way that I did this, you know? And he says, I keep trying to figure out why it was me, like why they picked me. And he's like, and he says this shit at the time that he says it, it blows my mind because it's before the trial started. It's while he's in jail. The only thing he's known from the time that he's in those interviews and never walks out of the police station again.
Yeah.
And is placed under arrest after the Holman interview. That guy has been incarcerated the whole fucking time.
Mm-hmm.
And when he says to his father, he says, the only thing I can think of is there was this election for the sheriff.
Fuck.
Mm-hmm.
And he fucking nails it. Like, in terms of a case that had gone cold for 5 years.
Yeah.
And they dig this thing up, if that's what we're to believe, that Kathy Shank somehow finds this file that was had vanished for 5 years, and it just appears in a thing, and she decides to take a peek at it, you know, decides to say, fuck it. I said, you know, it says cleared, but I'm gonna take another look at this thing. It seems more nefarious than that. The people that they knew that were out at that bridge, that they had their fucking names, that they said, it's time. We've got to make a fucking arrest here. Ron Logan's dead.
Right.
We can't make an arrest. That doesn't help us saying, hey, we're going to pin it on the dead guy because no one gets convicted there.
Yep.
And they said, you know what? This dude was out there. I think we can make it fit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what the fuck they did.
It's what it feels like.
And the reality is, if it is that you know, she picked this file up, hey, let's just take another look at this. Okay, great. Take another look at it. And there's nothing to see. I mean, the reasonable thing when you're going through that file to go, okay, well, that doesn't match here. That really doesn't match there. Okay, well, we looked, you know. Done. But no, where they're like, let's pound this square peg into the round hole no matter what. Yeah. And that's really basically what they did this. Let's go on talking about what's going on in prison. 13 months, that's how long Richard Allen spent in maximum security, solitary confinement before his trial, in case you're just joining us, in a unit called Westville Correctional Unit, designed for what prison officials call the worst of the worst. Allen had never been arrested before. He was a pretrial detainee, presumed innocent. You don't put people there in that sort of a state. That's for hardened, convicted criminals, not someone who's been accused of the crime and awaiting trial. But as you were alert in this case, nothing is as it should be. And according to the appeal, he was the first safekeeper anyone at IDOC could remember ever being placed in that unit. The results were predictable because the state of Indiana already knew what prolonged solitary does to people with serious mental illnesses. They'd been sued over it before. They settled. They had a 30-day policy for exactly this reason, but they allegedly kept Allen in a strip cell for over a year anyway, watching him deteriorate from a coherent 180-pound man into a 135-pound psychotic shell who smeared feces on himself, drank toilet water, and confessed to murders while asking if he was dead. The state then used those confessions to convict him. Bob Mana is with us, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, to help us break more of this down. The appeal references a federal court order and a settlement, IPAS versus IDOC, that found Indiana's practice of housing seriously mentally ill inmates in solitary constituted cruel and unusual punishment. That settlement established a 30-day limit. Allen was there for 13 months. Why do they have, does it even matter? I mean, they have this limit, but it's not followed. Walk me through what the hell's going on at this prison.
Well, I mean, I wish I could tell you. I don't think that, I don't think that this is how other inmates are handled.
No.
You know, and what's,
I'd love to know.
I'd love to know as well.
And how do they decide who ends up in solitary? What do you know the criteria to put somebody in that?
Well, typically, if you're, I mean, here's the thing that you can never forget, Stacey. When we're talking about Richard Allen, we're talking about a pretrial detainee, a man who is innocent, who's being housed in a prison, Okay. Yeah. Like people, like if you're not clear about how this typically works, the way that it typically works is when you're arrested and if you're not either afforded bond or you can't make your bond, you are housed in a county jail awaiting trial. Mm-hmm. Now that can take up to a couple few years just sitting in jail. Jails and prisons are two different things.
They are.
Yeah, very, very different things. So Richard Allen, when he is initially arrested, they skulk into the courtroom and they say, hey, you know what? And this is, again, back when Judge Diener, the original judge, was on this case, who mysteriously decided to recuse himself, quoting, saying that the bloodlust was just too much for him to remain involved with this case. So he's like, I'm going to take a step back. That's when Gall gets appointed as a special judge on this case. Yeah. So it's important to know. But leading into that, and these are important facts that I want people to know because it goes directly on how this whole thing ended up the way that it did and why this safekeeping order is such an important thing. When Richard Allen is initially arrested, leading up to the days before he is transferred, I believe, from Cass County to Westville, okay, Richard had told Kathy, his wife, he's like, I need you to get us a lawyer. So Kathy had been hunting around, found a lawyer, paid the lawyer $5,000. And this is after Holman's like, I am going to arrest you. When Rick said, go ahead, fucking arrest me. Good luck proving it. You know, like that whole part of the interrogation. Holman's like, bet, I got you. That's exactly what I'm going to do. He does. So Kathy goes home. She finds a lawyer. They pay him $5,000. They don't know where Rick's at. So he's trying to make calls. So he's making calls to the sheriff's department, Carroll County, of Cass County. He's talking to prosecutors in Carroll County. He's trying to figure out where Rick is, right? And hold on, I apologize. I'm fighting a cold and I have to
call. No worries.
At least I have the courtesy to hit the cough button.
Yeah.
So ultimately, everybody's on notice at that point, Tony and Stacey, that Rick Allen has a fucking lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So notwithstanding that, they go into the court, they get in front of Diener, and they say, all right, without any articulation of or evidence that Rick Allen's life is in danger. There's been no actual threat. Okay. Which is one of the things you either have to, in order to have somebody put under a safekeeping order, you either have to be a threat to others, like an actual threat to others. Like this guy's going to come in and fucking Hannibal Lecter, everybody that he gets in contact with, or they have to be concerned that the other inmates are going to kill him. And it's got to be proven by credible threat.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is they just come in and they say, well, this is a high-profile case. He's accused of being a child murderer, and we know what happens to child murderers in prison. While that may be true, that is not an actual fucking threat.
Yeah.
So whether they use that, so they go in without giving any notice. So that takes place, that safekeeping order is entered, stamped by the judge. Here you go. Without Richard Allen being present in court, without Richard Allen's attorney being present in court, without Richard Allen having notice that they were going to be in court, without Richard Allen's attorney being given notice that they're going to be into court. And on top of that, the problem for the state in this matter, and you know, brilliant habeas lawyer that we're very close with, who's an Indiana lawyer who wins 50% of his habeas cases, which is unheard of. And that's post-conviction stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, this is one of the biggest issues for him. And the problem for the state in this particular situation is the fact that Richard Allen had a choice in the matter. They should have hauled him in. Cause if the thing is like, hey, they're worried about my safety, so they're going to transfer me to a prison or a more secure location. Richard Allen had the option to say, thanks, but no thanks. I'm good. I'll try to stick it out in the jail. They didn't give him that option. That right of his was violated. So this thing, this thing is put into place. He's shipped off to Westville. And I you know, we you and I, Tony, have probably talked about this concept a thousand times in all the lives that we've done and all the recordings we've put together. The concept that when you have the evidence that you were just talking about, which is, where is it? Yeah. You got an unspent round and you got mere presence at the fucking bridge and that's it. Yeah. And you've got like, you've got eyewitnesses, none of which identify Richard Allen. When you are the prosecutor on that, on a case like that, and they pull the trigger on the arrest and you're like, I think we can get it done. We're going to need more. We're going to need more though. They're hoping obviously that after post arrest, that when they do the search of Richard Allen's house and specifically his devices, you can, if you could get Nick McClellan and Jerry Holman in a fucking room and put them, strap them to a lie detector and say, how much were you relying on finding shit in his devices that either linked him to the girls, that linked him to the Odin fucks, that showed some predilection for child porn or fucking murder porn, anything that would reflect that this is a guy that was building up as a 48-year-old man to go out on a bridge and decide after he left his mom's house to kill two little fucking girls that he didn't know were going to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
meanwhile, there's actual suspects. There's actual people that fit those descriptions.
Right.
And we're in communication with one of the girls as well.
Exactly.
So but it's all those folks,
nothing to see here.
So it's all to say that when you're dealing with that and you're dealing with those realities, with those problems with the case, they needed confessions, T. That's what they needed. When they went and they searched, they found nothing on any of his device, nothing. Nothing, no connection to the girls, no shit where you're like, oh my God, like, see, you know, like, holy shit, this guy's a fucking twisted fuck. None of that shit is found on his devices. They realize
you've
got to get the confessions.
And none of this is done in a very slick way either by the people that need to get the confessions, by the investigators.
They're not slick people.
Not at all. But I mean, what just baffles me is like, okay, if you're gonna try and backdoor this thing, you're gonna think you don't want people to see, you know, sloppy work. The whole fucking thing is sloppy. Like it's just like if you could it's like a bomb going off. Everything is scorched. Everything's fucked up. And they're like, "See, we got in. We did what we needed to do." Like, yeah, but that's not how you get into this room. You don't blow up the wall. Yeah. I don't know. I'm just even the thought process of, okay, well, let's drive him nuts. We know he has this D mental health code, and they got that 30-day limit, but we're gonna keep him there for 13 months. And by the time he's eating his shit, this is going to be a really good confession. And then they take it and they're like, see, it's a really good confession. It's like, no, it's not. But they were betting the whole time that the system was going to say, yeah, it's a really good confession. When I think everybody on the outside would be looking at this going, well, no one's going to fucking buy this. This is not credible. But everybody bought it and said it's credible. Which, I don't know. It's like we're living in the bizarro land here with this case.
The question is not whether or not it's necessarily credible. The question is whether or not it's voluntary.
Yeah, that from, too. From the all of the above.
Right. You know, and it's like, you know, again, when you're looking at the way that the appellate court is going to be forced to look at these issues, which if you're looking at it as a layperson, you're like, what in the fuck is going on here? And you know, they're forced to look at it in such a way, you know, in the light most favorable to the state. And they're going to look at these things where, because you can tell, and IT, I know you went through the whole appeal, but, you know, the confessions are the thing that they feel the most strongly about in terms of the appellate attorneys, because that's where they spend a bulk of their time, right?
Yeah.
You know, so you know this is a thing that, you know, they really feel like is a potential winner here. And I hope that it is, because what happened to Richard Allen is fucking criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But what happened to Richard Allen should terrify every single American in this country, because if that were your father or your brother or your mother or your sister, I don't give a fuck who it is. If that were your family and you were to find out that is what happened to a person that is presumed innocent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I cannot state that enough.
Yeah.
People that don't understand, people that think that once somebody is fucking arrested, that they are a guilty person, are wrong. That is not how it works in this country. We require the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that we have committed a crime that they are fucking accusing us of committing. We can't have it any other way. You know, so in that situation, man, you know, when you're sitting here thinking about just the way that he was treated, and you're looking at it from just the human perspective, it's nauseating.
It is.
I mean, and then when you look at it, it is. And when you look at it from the legal perspective, it scares me because I just don't know if it's going to be a situation where these appellate court judges are going to say, like, well, you know, the way that the judge looked at it is that he was treated as well or better than everybody else in that fucking prison. And did the defense do enough on the record to say, okay, those are convicted fucking felons. You're comparing a pretrial detainee who should be giving way more privileges than a convicted murderer or child R-er. You're comparing a man who is factually, at this point in time, innocent. He is presumed to be factually innocent until it's proven otherwise. And he was being held 13 months like he's in Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah.
Just, it is mind-blowing.
It's mind-blowing. And the thing that I just want to impress about people, and you know, he came in with major depressive disorder. He came in with this dependency personality thing. Like, I always forget what the fuck it's called. It's basically where, like, you have an absolute dependency on another person to give you your worth because you feel like you have no self-worth. And Kathy Allen was that woman for 35 plus years to the man that she's been with since they were teenagers. Like he had this, and this all predated the murders by decades. This isn't that thing where, like, oh, well, he became depressed because he killed two little girls and was very guilty. No, this predates all of it.
It's insane.
Thank you.
There's so many insane elements to this case. Another one is what the jury never heard. Let's talk about that. A jury convicted Richard Allen of murdering Abby Williams and Libby German. But according to the appeal, that jury was operating with one hand tied behind its back. They never saw Betsy Blair's sketch, the one that she rated 10 out of 10 for accuracy that looked nothing like Allen. They never heard expert testimony challenging the reliability of the state's bullet matching methodology. They never learned that the state's detail only the killer would know was actually contradicted by the state's own defense. They never heard the audio of Allen screaming incoherently in solitary while the state claimed his confessions were logical and organized. And they never heard a word about Brad Holder, Patrick Westfall, or the extensive investigation into whether this was a ritualistic killing connected to Norse paganism. The trial court excluded all of it. Bob Mata is with us to talk about this other ball of shit in this case that makes the case just as outrageous as it's getting more outrageous as we learn more, I think, over time, especially with the new appellate briefs that are out. Let's start with the sketch. This is a big one. Betsy Blair, she's the key eyewitness to Bridge Guy. She worked with the sketch artist 3 days after the murders, and she said she could identify Bridge Guy if she saw him again, but the jury never saw the sketch. How does excluding it affect Allen's ability to argue mistaken identity if they can't even get the damn thing into court? Let's talk about these pieces that were never shown to a jury.
I'd be so pissed if I were on that jury. If I heard all of this now, I would be effing livid at this point.
I don't know, because like these people that were on this jury, you know, when you're on a jury, Stacey, you want to walk away from that thing feeling like you fucking got it right. And your brain is going to work in ways that is going to justify that you did it right. It's like a situation where I think there's enough to pound them over the head to show that you fucked it up, but you've got to be willing to do that work and to do that listening as a juror who's convicted somebody in order to get there. And I don't know that any of these jurors are in that position. We've only heard one of them talk, which to me,
that might be telling in itself right there.
Right.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
Exactly.
People do not want to go and raise a flag going, yeah, I think we fucked that up. Typically, when you see the jurors talk, they're usually like, yeah, we think we did the right thing.
Yeah. I mean, I've only heard one of them speaking. So that thing not coming in, the first sketch and the second sketch didn't come in either.
No.
You know, and in terms of the judge's reasoning as to why, I don't really know. You know,
there doesn't seem to be a lot of reasoning.
I don't know. Like, you know, it's like, is it a hearsay situation? Because I mean, like, people always think hearsay is words. Hearsay can be pictures. It can be composite sketches. It could be, you know, these were out of court statements made by Betsy Blair. And theoretically, the defense would be arguing she gave it a 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
We are offering it for the truth of the matter that fucking composite, you know, that composite is representing the truth of the matter that it asserts that is who she said she saw. And that fucking guy isn't our client, you know? So like that, and that's why, and the other part of it is she's testifying. They can ask her, okay, well, what was the person that you described, which they did. But it doesn't have the same impact, does it? In terms of having Betsy Blair on the stand saying, okay, well, you know, he was boyish, young, 20s, maybe 30, you know, poofy brown hair, youthful face, you know, and it's like you're sitting here, you're looking at nearly bald Richard Allen, buzz cut, you know, fucking 5'4", nothing youthful looking about him. And it just like completely different dude.
I know,
you know, and like the bigger frustration for me is, and that is, I think, something that when you kind of look at everything, Tony, and this is one of my criticisms of the brief. And again, I think they did yeoman's work, because what you realize is that with 24,000 words, it goes quick, man. And you've got to pick your poisons. You've got to, like, every word matters.
They were limited to
14, Stace, and they filed for an motion for extension of an additional 10,000 words. So originally this case that has so many issues was going to be limited to 14,000 words, and they got the extra 10,000. So you have to pick your poisons. But the one thing that I would have loved to have seen is just some cumulative argument that, okay, each of these little things in and of themselves, appellate court judges, maybe you think that they're all independently harmless error. But when you look at them cumulatively together, it becomes clear on what happened here. And it just didn't really make that argument. And I don't, like, I mean, it exists without them saying it. But I don't know if that kind of waves the issue moving forward. So, you know, like I'm sitting there at the trial, Tony, and they don't ask one single eyewitness, do you see the man that you saw on the trails that day in the courtroom?
How do you not ask that?
Could you point him out for us and tell us what he's wearing?
They even do that on shows on TV. I mean,
I mean, it's an in-court identification.
God.
That
if
you're confident, if you're coming in and trying a guy on the up and up, if you fucking believe that you got the guy, then why aren't you getting an in-court ID? If you feel like, even if you know that they're gonna say, I don't know. I can't say with 100% certainty that he's the guy. What, like, one says he has a face covering. Betsy's like, he doesn't seem like. If you feel so confident in your other evidence that Richard Allen did this, then why aren't you trying the case on the up and up? And then I can ask the same question to the defense attorneys. I'm not giving them a pass here. Why the fuck didn't you ask them? Because you know what? In Indiana, you get to depose every single person. And we don't get that opportunity in Illinois. I go in blind. I go in on police reports, rarely having the opportunity to ever talk to state witnesses because they call the state and they say, hey, there's some lawyer fucking at my door. What should I do? State's attorney can't tell them. You don't talk to him. Fucking try. Mm-hmm. What they say is, well, you know, you're testifying on our behalf and it's your choice. You can tell them to go fuck off. You have no obligation to talk to them. And that's what they do most of the time. Mm-hmm. In Indiana, you get to put them under oath and sit in a room with them and depose them and ask them, here's my client. This is a photograph of our client, the guy they've arrested for this crime when Betsy Blair's sitting at the depth table. Mm-hmm. Slide across. Is this the fucking guy that you saw?
Yeah.
And Betsy Blair answers the question. Like what? Like
missed opportunity.
Missed opportunity. My God. Are they afraid of the answer? Is where you're like, which is true. A legitimate thing. I mean, because it exists in the world.
Because at some point, did they convince Betsy that this is the person you saw too? I mean, you're rolling the dice there, you know, and it's been all those years. The other thing on this is that damn bullet. And it just baffles me that this even got as far as it did, which is like the only piece of evidence. And they put that in air quotes because it's not. You have the bullet, the unspent round that did not match when they cycled it through the gun, because they did it the same way. Unspent round, cycle it through, no match. How do they get the match? They fired the bullet. Completely different method. Completely different. It's in no way the same sort of thing. And then they say, see, it matches. Yes, you fired the round. That's not the same damn thing. But somehow, in magic land of Delphi, this is admissible evidence, and we're no way in hell going to let the defense expert in here, William Tobin, the nationally recognized forensic metrologist who's testified in 297 cases about the scientific community's criticism of this methodology. No, he can't come in and say anything. We're just going to do this where it's really not even truly the same damn thing. It's apples to oranges, and we're going to say, see, it's a match, everybody, and this is what the jury is going to believe, because they're presented it to them in a very skewed way. I'm just, I don't know, there's so many elements to this. This is another obviously key one to this case, where if this was explained adequately to a jury, I don't think we would have Richard Allen in prison.
Yeah.
So here's, this will make you feel better, T. Just remember, Oberg, the state's expert, their tool marking expert, mm-hmm. She's never been wrong, buddy. It's okay.
Oh, yeah. She's never been wrong.
She's never been wrong, buddy.
Never been wrong. That's what they said.
She's never been wrong.
Never been challenged either, but never had the work reviewed.
I sat there at that trial, okay, every fucking day, you know, and we got this dude, Hunter Johnson, in here, who's like a super troll. It's been in my chat. I don't know who he is. He's calling us sick fucks.
Let's block him.
Yeah, I mean, like, were you at the trial, dude? Do you know anything about this case, or are you just that guy? You know, it's like at this point, like, this isn't a fucking game.
No.
There's a guy in prison who I believe with all of my heart is innocent.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And this isn't a fucking joke. This isn't some social media bullshit. This isn't Twitter. This is a real life thing that we're watching in real time. And we live in a world in which we now have the ability to be able to comment on it. Thankfully.
And don't forget, it could be any one of us sitting in this chat, in this video right now. It could be any one of us. If you live in this country, this should concern you. It should concern you in other countries, but especially here, because it's not supposed to fucking happen here.
If you went for a hike that day and you raised your hand and said, how can I help? I was down there.
Exactly.
This is what happened to him.
Yep.
it's insane. It is such an insane case.
So I got sidetracked because I saw that dude. And I've got a lot of our fam in chat today.
And they love your haircut, by the way. Somebody said, oh, Bob, no hat.
I know. I decided to go hatless. So sitting there watching Oberg testify, Tony, was Insane. I don't know any other way to put it other than it was insane. Because she gets up there, they show like three pictures of the significant agreement, you know, and then she goes to great lengths with McClelland on direct to say, I don't want the jury to look at these pictures because it's a snapshot of everything that I looked at. Like, I couldn't possibly show you everything that I took into consideration in order to reach the decision that there was significant agreement between the round that I fired with all that pressure that causes a projectile to fly through the barrel of a gun. Yeah. When I compared it to the ejected round that just popped out and I found significant agreement, she did this. She went to such lengths to say, I just don't want you to look at the pictures because it's not what I use. It's a microscopic portion of what I relied on in reaching this conclusion. And I was sitting there, I'm like, what? Is this fucking woman sitting there with like a trust me, bro? Like, is that what she's doing right now? Trust me, bro. I've never been wrong. Trust me, bro. You're going to have to just take my word. I don't want you to look at those pictures because that's
don't check the work.
Dude, and look, Rosie did the best that he could, and he did a really nice job on that cross. And you know, and they had their own expert. But I knew that was coming in Indiana. Like everybody that I talked to that practiced in Indiana, I was like, that shit's coming in. Like she's not like even if it wasn't Gull, that unspent round, and the state was going to be able to put an expert on. So that wasn't necessarily like a Gull thing.
It's just I expect the expert to be an expert and be presenting accurate work. You know, that's apples to oranges bullshit. That's not what I expect from an expert. That's what I expect from someone who doesn't know what the fuck they're doing. Yeah. And like, well, this doesn't work. This is not the same. Oh, okay. I was unaware of that. I'm not an expert. But this is an expert. They should be like, yes, completely different things. You can't compare the two. It's not going to be an accurate comparison, period. Right.
Full stop. And the one thing that I think in relation to that, her barring the metallurgist that they were trying to call, the defense was trying to call, would have explained the concept of pressure and heat and how it affects metal would have been very helpful to a jury in understanding the difference between racking a round out of the top of your weapon firing it. And she denied that. So like that's a part of it where I think the appellate courts can be like, you know what? That's kind of a problem. That's something that I think the judge erred on. So the question then becomes, is it harmless error? You know, because that's always what it's going to boil down to. Because if it's structural error, that means it's a redo. If we find that something on its face is violative of the law and just flat out wrong, it's structural error, the analysis stops there, and this guy gets a new trial. Yeah. I don't know. Like Michael Losbrook has identified something that he firmly believes was structural error, and it wasn't necessarily argued in this appeal. Mm-hmm. But again, like I trust the lawyers that are handling the appeal for Richard Allen. They're excellent appellate attorneys.
Yeah.
They went through this record, you know, and you have to simply trust that they picked what they felt in their experience was the strongest issues in terms of hoping to get him a new trial. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like that whole remanding it for a Franks hearing to go back to the first thing that we talked about. And I know that you clip these, T, but like you're going in front of Gull.
Yeah.
That's going to have no impact. If they say, okay, we're going to remand it for the Franks, which is a weird thing to think. He's sitting there convicted. They're saying, okay, we're going to send it back to have her, force her to do the hearing. what do you think the result of that's going to be?
Exactly. Everything was damned if you do, damned if you don't in this because of her.
Yeah.
But my God, it's going to be an interesting year, 2026, to see what transpires next in all this. Bob Mata, Defense Diaries. Check it out wherever you get podcasts and on YouTube as well. And if you're looking for another one to listen to right now,
Buried Inside the John Wayne Gacy Investigation. I let you
there, big guy. Buried Inside the John Wayne Gacy Investigation, also available wherever you get podcasts. Very, very greatly. I love the production on it. You did a great job on that.
Thank you, my friend.
Go check that out as well.
Thank you, my friend.
All right. That's going to wrap up this episode of the program. So for Stacy, for Todd, for Bob, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.